FM Rewind, 88.1.
Let's give Caitlin a warm welcome. Caitlin?
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on, and hello to all the listeners.
Thank you so much for making this time. So I just wanted to begin, right, could you explain how genetics influences the way our bodies respond to medicines, especially when it comes to liver health?
Definitely. So genetics affects how our bodies make the enzymes, transporters, and receptors that process the medications that we ingest.
Mm.
So many of these proteins that process these drugs are found in the liver. The liver is seen as the hub of drug metabolism.
Mm-hmm.
However, various what we call variations, or in genetic terms, polymorphisms, as you can see, all of the scientific terms are very long and complicated. But these polymorphisms can cause a person to metabolize drugs very quickly or metabolize drugs very slowly.
Mm.
And because of that, we need to adjust the amount of drug that is given to a person.
Interesting. So what are some of the common liver diseases seen in children, and why do these conditions sometimes lead to the need for a transplant?
So there are various common liver diseases in children.
Mm.
For example, biliary atresia, and the timing of this call is actually really important because yesterday, the 1st of December, was World Biliary Atresia Day.
Mm.
And what happens in biliary atresia is that there's a blockage or absence of bile ducts.
Mm.
And within the liver, this leads to progressive liver damage if untreated. So the doctors and the liver transplant team at the Fitzdonald Gordon Medical Center are really highlighting biliary atresia as one of the main forms of liver disease seen in children in South Africa, and are actually encouraging awareness around this disease, for example, through the World Awareness Day yesterday.
Mm. Hmm. So in what ways does pediatric liver disease differ in its causes, symptoms, or progression compared to adults?
So in children, you see, as a child is born, normally there are not that many environmental influences. So usually liver disease and most other diseases present as genetic or developmental.
Mm.
Whereas in adults, we liver disease, we see commonly liver disease caused by alcohol-induced liver disease, fatty liver disease, or viral hepatitis. So in terms of symptoms, children often show failure to thrive, are jaundiced, have pale stool, and are irritable.
Mm.
Whereas in adults, you see more of a fatigue, jaundice, and abdominal swelling.
Mm. Mm. So after a transplant, how do genetic differences between individual children shape how well they respond and recover?
So what's really important to understand is the research that I was conducting is in living donor liver transplants.
Mm-hmm.
So the Fitzdonald Gordon Medical Center initiated this amazing transplant technology in 2012, which allows them to harvest a graft from a living donor, which in pediatric cases is usually a mother or a father. So they take a lobe from a living person, take that liver lobe, and transplant it into the patient.
Mm.
So how this affects the genetics is, as I've explained, the liver is a hub for drug metabolism. So if you have a liver transplant, the genetics from the donor is transplanted into the recipient. And therefore, the immunosuppression with the drug called tacrolimus is linked to those genetics. So variants such as CYP3A5, CYP3A4, and ABCB1, which are some of the very intricate genetic cookbooks for the drug metabolism enzymes allow us to balance the risk of rejection and the risk of toxicity.
Still on that point, like you were saying, the liver is known to be the central to drug metabolism. Could you explain why this organ is important for processing medication and what happens when its function is impaired?
And that's exactly what happens after a liver transplant. It takes a while for the liver to fully regain function. So within the liver, what happens is the drugs are transformed into inactive or active forms.
Mm-hmm.
The liver is also responsible for detoxifying any harmful substances that are put into a body. And this is where you can also induce liver damage. Mm. So if you take too much of the wrong medication, you can go into drug-induced liver injury, which is also very dangerous.
Mm.
So this breakdown in the liver allows us to really process all of the medications, but specifically in children, they need very specific doses in order to maintain a very balanced seesaw between too much drug and too little drug. Too much drug leading to toxicity, drug-induced injury, and too little drug leading to rejection of the transplanted organ.
Mm. So, Caitlin, I just want to know, out of curiosity, because I just wanted to, is it recommended sometimes to use home remedies like your homemade concoctions sometimes instead of using pharmaceutical drugs? Because sometimes, some people don't necessarily have access to like a proper healthcare and stuff. So how does, homemade concoctions or homemade remedies, how can they damage the liver? How bad can they damage the liver?
So I'm not a medical doctor, so I won't be able to comment on the intricacies of your question.
Oh, okay.
But what, to my knowledge, what I understand is some of the herbal or medicinal concoctions that are made at home can lead to drug-induced liver injury. But saying that, so can paracetamol, which is found in things like panado. So I think there's something really, the liver is an amazing organ in terms of it's this hub for drug metabolism. It has regenerative ability, but it's also very, very sensitive. Mm. And we need to know what we're putting in our bodies. So whether it is pharmaceuticals or at-home remedies, we need to be cognizant of what we're putting into our bodies and protect our livers as much as possible.
Mm, okay. Before we move into your specialized work, could you explain what pharmacogenetics is and why it is especially important for children who receive liver transplants?
Definitely. So pharmacogenetics or pharmacogenomics is the study of how genetics and pharmaceuticals interact.
Mm.
So for pharmacogenomics, you study how the genetic differences influence the way a person metabolizes and responds to medication. So, for example, in liver transplants, there's a very narrow therapeutic index. As I explained, you can imagine a seesaw in a playground with the levels going up and the levels going down, seesawing between that balance that the doctors need to achieve. So using pharmacogenetic information can help clinicians personalize treatment, leading to a safer and more stable recovery. And for pediatric patients, this means reducing ICU time after transplant and really getting them back into the routine that they need to be in to thrive.
Mm, okay. So when a child metabolizes medication faster or slower because of their genetics, what does that mean in practical terms for their treatment, safety, and long-term care?
So what we found in our research is that the one genetic variant means that a certain population metabolizes tacrolimus faster and another metabolizes it slower. And what we've been able to do then is implement genotype-guided testing. And we're working towards this goal of being able to implement this in the living donor transplants so that you can take a blood test from a living donor so that you don't have to have any more tests run on the pediatric patient. And you can see what genetics profile the liver that is going to be transplanted has. And this allows us in long-term care, helps avoid repeated hospitalizations, makes sure that the child is getting the correct drug at the correct time, and then prevents further complications. So really, really important in terms of clinical care.
Well, one striking real-world example is the world's first living donor liver transplant from an HIV-positive mother to her HIV-negative child. Could you explain why this case is genetically interesting?
So this was a major, major a great event for the Vitz Ronald Gordon Medical Center. I was not involved in this case at all, but I can explain a little bit in terms of the HIV-positive mother donating part of her liver is remarkable because the donor liver contains the HIV genetic material. And as I explained earlier, when you do a living donor liver transplant, that genetic material is also transplanted to the recipient. So you can see from this case there are a lot of complexities in terms of making sure that the HIV status wasn't transferred to the recipient. But it also looks at virus host genetics, immune tolerance, and transplant immunology.
As we continue our discussion, Africa carries a heavy burden of liver disease by very few transplant centers. How does this shortage affect children who need diagnosis and treatment?
So that's a great question and really highlights some of the challenges that we face on the African continent. So between my master's research, which focused on children and pediatric patients, for my PhD, we switched over to researching autoimmune hepatitis in adults. And what we saw here is there is an earlier age of diagnosis, and as you explained, more progressive disease towards cirrhosis. But on the African continent, you can count on one hand how many transplant centers there are. There are two in South Africa, one at the Vitz Ronald Gordon Medical Center, and then there's this major gap all the way up to Egypt, Cairo. So in that major gap, there's delayed diagnosis, long waiting times, limited access to specialized biopsies, financial and travel barriers, and therefore a higher mortality. But what happens is there's also no liver disease registry currently available for the African continent. So we don't have a specific idea of what exactly the liver disease profile looks like. We know that there's a major contribution from viral hepatitis, but autoimmune hepatitis seems to be coming in very significantly in some of the local clinics, and that's why it's the focus of my PhD.
So autoimmune hepatitis in South Africa, especially in children of African ancestry, looks different from what we see globally. What makes our local cases so unique?
So in children versus in adults there's this earlier onset of disease. So you see patients around 25 to 30 years old who have no history of alcohol abuse, drug abuse, smoking, or any other external factors that would contribute towards liver damage. And they live relatively healthy lives, and one day start feeling very fatigued, become jaundiced, and then the doctor sends them for liver enzyme tests, and they see that the liver enzymes are deranged and are higher than they're supposed to be, and are referred for a liver biopsy, and the histology reveals that autoimmune hepatitis is the cause of all of this.
Hmm. You highlighted earlier diagnosis, fast progression to cirrhosis, and high recurrence after transplant. Why do these patterns matter for pediatric care?
So in the Witwatersrand Medical Center, what's really important is that we want to be able to get patients the treatment that they need. But if there's a fast progression to end-stage liver disease and full-blown cirrhosis, then there's not that much time in order to, one, get listed for transplant, and two, to find a suitable donor. So it's really a balance in terms of that. But also recurrence after transplant tells us that there's really an underlying immune dysregulation that persists within the body. So we really need to understand these patterns in order to tailor our local guidelines of healthcare and not rely on data that's produced, for example, in Europe or North America.
Mm. Your research relies on liver biopsies. How are biopsies collected in children, and why are they so important for understanding this disease?
So I collect liver biopsies specifically from adult patients. Mm-hmm. And what's involved is a local anesthetic, and then the doctor inserts a hollow, thin needle through the abdomen into the liver using ultrasound as a guide, and then through that hollow needle sticks the biopsy needle, which then allows us to collect a specimen from the liver. And this is really important because what research has established is currently, the only research available for autoimmune hepatitis using transcriptomics is using blood. Mm-hmm. And although this is valuable, what's difficult is it doesn't reflect the true nature of the genetics. And if you think of genetics as almost a cookbook that allows us to read the recipes and make the chocolate cake. Mm-hmm. In blood, it's like reading the cookbook through a distorted lens. You can kind of understand the recipes, but you don't have a clear picture.
Okay.
When you are able to take a liver biopsy, you're able to see exactly what's going wrong within the liver, and that's really important for understanding the disease.
Africa has a huge genetic diversity, so why is it important to generate local Afrocentric data instead of relying on international studies?
So it's well known and well established that Africa harbors the greatest genetic diversity, but many immune variants found in the African population are not represented in global studies. And additionally, results, both clinical and genetic, from European, North American, and Asian populations may not apply to African populations. There are certain disease patterns, like we're seeing with autoimmune hepatitis, in terms of severity, progression, and from my master's, the tacrolimus treatment response, driven by genetics unique to our local populations. So without this local data, clinicians rely on international guidelines that were not, one, designed for African context, but also haven't been robustly tested in our local population. So the focus of this collaborative study is really to have African researchers researching African populations and prioritizing African diseases that are prevalent in Africa.
Okay. So just to take you back a little bit, right? You're using single nuclear RNA sequencing, the cookbook that you touched on. Because I'm just afraid that somewhere, somehow, it might have flew over the listener's head. In simple terms, how does this technique work and what new information does it reveal?
So as I alluded to earlier, I think of genetics like a cookbook. And what I'm studying are the individual recipes. So, for example, you'll have a chocolate cake and banana muffins. But sometimes what happens within these recipes is you mistakenly add a spoonful of sugar instead of a spoonful of salt. And then the recipe gets all messed up and you don't really understand why the finished product has come out a little bit too salty or too sweet. So this can also happen within cells. And the cookbook is our genome, our DNA, and the individual recipes are RNA. So what I'm doing is I'm isolating individual cells and looking at the RNA within those cells in order to characterize what's happening within the liver tissue.
So you faced challenges like limited samples, high sequencing costs, and the need for specialized training. Why is this the case, and how have these affected your project?
So it's really, really important in terms of the novelty and the impact of this project. So the liver biopsy samples are very rare and very precious. So what we're able to do using single cell or single nuclear RNA sequencing is from one sample harvest approximately 60,000 cells. So that allows us to increase our statistical power and makes every sample that we collect at the Witwatersrand Gordon Medical Center extremely crucial. Then in terms of the high sequencing costs, if you talk to anyone in this very emerging field, single-cell technologies are very, very expensive. And so even in South Africa, where it's not widely adopted, there's scarce funding. And also, because the samples are so precious, there's a lot of emphasis on making sure that you get results from the samples. In terms of the specialized training, running the experiments, managing the terabytes of data that gets produced from them, and then analyzing the results in a bioinformatic capacity require skills that are really still emerging on the African continent. So I was really, really lucky to be selected as one of the Novartis Next Generation Scientist interns. And I spent 3 months in Switzerland learning how to conduct these analyses. And it's so critical that we're able to do that and able to represent African data on an international stage.
A study like this needs many partners. What role does teamwork and collaboration across hospitals and labs play?
It is so, so important. Collaboration is one of my biggest pushes. And I really want to give a shout out to the clinicians, the pathologists, the lab scientists, the research scientists, the bioinformaticians, and some of our other collaborators, both at the Witwatersrand Gordon Medical Center, at the Council for the Scientific and Industrial Research, and at the University of the Witwatersrand, to really say a big thank you for this cross-disciplinary teamwork, because this is the way that we're able to transfer and build a bridge between science and patient care in order to ensure that patients receive the best treatment they can possible.
Caitlin, with some of, you know, the highlights, that apart from the ones that you've mentioned, what are some of the highlights can you share with us, if you don't mind, that you've encountered along this journey in your project?
Oh, there's been a few, but from the end of my master's, I graduated from BITS with my master's, and I remember standing in front of the Great Hall and really, really feeling this overwhelming sense of pride for the university that we represent. And I think that's something that has flown and grown in my PhD. We really conduct such amazing research at FITS, and I'm very, very proud to be a PhD candidate there. Mm. But I think one of the main highlights has definitely been the opportunities to learn through this project, both about myself as a researcher, and that has come from interacting with patients, interacting with clinicians, and interacting with scientists, but also learning about all of the different research gaps that exist within our clinical landscape, and how we really need African-focused research in order to fill those.
Mm. And finally, what impact do you hope this research will have for children, whether in early diagnosis, better treatments, or improved long-term outcomes?
So this research in establishing single-cell reference maps for autoimmune hepatitis is going to focus on specifically how the disease progresses in adults. And we're aiming to look at identifying high-risk patients sooner, develop more personalized strategies, and also reduce the recurrence after transplant. So this research will provide the first Afrocentric single-cell map of autoimmune hepatitis from South Africa, and really close long-standing gaps in global knowledge to ensure that this liver disease is represented and that the patients are able to receive the treatment they need.
Caitlin, with the work that you do, I believe that comes with a lot of pressure, and sometimes it can be quite overwhelming. For somebody that is pretty much wants to head into the same journey as you, what advice would you give them when the going gets tough? How do you keep on, how do you stay motivated whenever you've encountered challenges? Would you mind sharing some of, you know, your ways on how to deal with whenever you have that overwhelming feeling, or when you feel like you want to give up? How do you keep going? How do you stay motivated in your journey?
Most definitely. What an important question to ask. And really, what I found is, and I'm saying this as someone who's still growing and learning within the field, is how important mentorship is. And I've been really, really lucky to have some incredible mentors throughout my journey. And specifically strong female women in STEM, and I've been really, really lucky to find those people. But also, I think one of the things that I learned early on in my career is to ask for help when it's needed. So all of my mentors that I have, I approach directly and asked, would you mind mentoring me in an official capacity, because it's hard sometimes to keep up with the daily routine as well as maintaining a balanced perspective between your work and your studies as well as your personal life. Especially when undertaking a PhD, you can find that you sometimes get lost within the research. And it's really important to reach out and be able to find people that have gone through the journey before you, but are also going through the journey with you. So I think mentorship and peer support is one of the cornerstones of that.
Caitlin, for people that would love to check out some of your work, or if they would love to ask, you know, any questions related to your work, where can they find you on the socials or?
Of course.
Yes.
So anyone's welcome to reach out to me on LinkedIn. You will easily find me, Caitlin Wheeler, and welcome to reach out via message and connect, because it would be really interesting to hear what other people have to say about this research, but also if I can provide any mentorship in my limited capacity, I'd happily do so.
Thank you so much, Caitlin. Thank you so much for making the time for having this conversation with us. All the best with everything that you do, and enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you so much for having me on, and have a lovely
thank you.
Evening further.
Thank you so much, Caitlin.
FM Rewind. File 88.1.